There's always another way, Crowther said, but not always more time or resources, especially now. We're at war, and we work with what we have. John nodded. All the same, I wish I could trade places with you and Sergeant Johnson today. Crowther chuckled. So do I. He let his gaze drift to the insignia on John's armor, then grew more serious. John, there's something that goes with that rank that you still don't have, and you need to get it straight. And fast. John's stomach tightened. I'm listening, sir. You should know that you earned a lot of respect at Seoba, and not just from me. Thank you, sir. Crowther motioned that he wasn't finished. And you're a good leader. Your Spartans would follow you into a fusion reactor if you asked them to. I'd do the same for them. I know you would, Crowther said. And that's the problem. Sometimes a good commander can't be a hero. You have to be willing to send your people into that reactor alone, if that's what it takes. And I honestly haven't seen that ability in you. Not once. John glanced toward Johnson, wondering if it was Crowther's words or Johnson's he was hearing. Both of them had been on him about leading from the front since the day his squad was attached to the 21st. I've lost Spartans in battle before, John said. I just try not to make it a habit. And I'm not encouraging you to, Crowther said. But that armor doesn't make you invincible. If you're always the first one in, and the one who takes the biggest chances, sooner or later you're going to get hit. What happens to the unit then? Fred takes over. Crowther rolled his eyes. And command continuity suffers. Even if Fred is as good as you are, it will take your people a couple of seconds to adjust. And a lot can happen in 2 seconds, Johnson added. A unit can get wiped out. John didn't reply. He knew they were right, but he just didn't like the idea of ordering his friends to take risks in his place. It seemed cowardly. But so did getting his squad wiped out because he was afraid to let somebody else take point. Johnson was right about that much. You could lose your entire unit in 2 seconds of combat. The commander of an elite unit has to trust his people as much as he trusts himself, Crowther said. You don't have that yet, and I'm not sure if it's something that you'll ever be comfortable with. But you're still young. An understatement, to be sure. And that level of trust is something you need to think about if you're going to live up to that insignia on your collar. Thank you, sir. I will. Crowther studied him for a moment, then finally nodded. You do that, Master Chief. He gave a curt nod to Johnson, then left the boarding vestibule and crossed the hangar to the Ghost Song, which would be serving as Dagger Force's command vessel. John was tempted to offer a salute, but he knew Nyeta would be trying to see what was happening inside the vestibule, and he didn't want an unnecessary show of respect to tip their hand. Johnson stepped in front of John. I guess this is goodbye, then, Master Chief. He was making a good show of smiling, but his eyes were stoic, and John knew he believed they would not be meeting again. You just remember what the colonel said. Do what you have to. The sergeant extended his hand. I will. John took the offered hand in his gauntlet and shook. Thanks for showing me how much I didn't learn on Reach. I needed the lessons. Johnson's eyes crinkled at the corners. Any time. He tried to withdraw his hand, but John held tight. I'm going to hold you to that, Sergeant Johnson. Johnson grew more somber. Then make it through this, he said. Listen to Crowther, and trust your people. The sergeant withdrew his hand and left the vestibule, then walked across the deck to board the Ghost Song. John returned to the hatch and watched for a second, trying to digest what had just happened. He was flattered by the promotion, of course, and proud that he had earned Crowther's respect to such an extent. But he was also keenly aware of the heavy responsibility that had just been laid on his shoulders. A 4-rank bump was so unheard of that it was bound to draw as much scrutiny from inferior ranks as it did from his equals and superiors. From that moment forward, John knew, he would have to prove in everything he did that he was worthy of such an honor. Linda 058 stepped into the vestibule behind him. When he turned around, her helmet tipped slightly, and he knew she was looking at the rank insignia affixed over his collar. "Nice bling," she said of her team comm. "Crowther's idea," John replied. "He says I need the cred." "Can't hurt," Linda said. "Just don't let it go to your head." "Thanks. I'll try not to." All Prowlers have checked in clean. "Anybody find anything?" John asked. Sierra Force had 4 Prowlers divided into 2 half-strength flights, and he had put Spartans aboard all of them, with orders to sweep for eavesdropping devices and keep a subtle eye on the crews. Aboard the Widow, that duty had fallen to Linda, while Fred and Kelly were in the drop bay, watching 3rd Platoon Delta Company. "Or take any guff?" "Negative on the guff," Linda reported. "But I found a bug in the Widow's wardroom, and Kurt found one in the Quiet Man's." John thought for a moment, then said, "I guess that's a good thing. It means Nayedo isn't counting on our flight commanders for updates." "It doesn't mean they're going to trust you when things start getting weird." John tapped his new rank insignia. "That's why I have the bling." As they spoke, a crewman was raising the ramp and securing exterior hatches for immediate launch. The Vanishing Point and its escort complement would be staying behind at Transit Node Badra, but the rest of the task force, or what remained of it after losing half its strength, over 400 troopers and 7 prowlers at the battles of Sayoba and Biko, was clustered in 2 nearby formations, awaiting the 2 command prowlers. Led by Nayeto, at least temporarily, Dagger Force was the larger of Yama's 2 strike forces, with 3 prowler flights carrying 3 half-strength space assault companies that numbered only 243 troopers between them. The mission plan called for it to depart first and approach the night side of the Covenant supply world, a planet they were designating Naraka. This attack was designed to draw out the defensive flotilla stationed at Libration Point 3. Sierra Force would follow a few minutes later and approach from the same side of the planet. Their primary objective was to infiltrate the remaining defenses and storm the orbital facilities that ringed Naraka. That was the plan, anyway. John didn't think the coming battle would actually unfold that way, and neither did Crowther or Johnson. They were expecting Nayeto to try to get the Spartans killed somewhere along the way. But how the traitorous commander would do that, and what would happen when Crowther and Johnson tried to stop him, was anyone's guess. The launch alarm sounded, and the Black Widow rose off her struts and exited the hangar. John barely noticed the acceleration anymore. He started forward toward the flight deck, while Linda remained amidship to keep a quiet eye on the crew. Fred and Kelly were in the drop bay with 3rd Platoon. John knew the bay wouldn't be as crowded as it had been when he and Avery Johnson had dropped with 1st Platoon Alpha back at Sayoba, which now seemed so long ago. While Delta Company had suffered less attrition than most of the battalion during the Battle of Biko, it had lost 43 troopers, and 3rd Platoon's strength had dropped from 40 ODSTs to 32. Still, he hoped that 3rd Platoon's lieutenant didn't take offense at what he was about to do. 32 ODSTs would be a tall order for a pair of Spartans to neutralize, especially if they were trying to avoid a lot of casualties. And the odds would be even worse for the Spartans on Sierra Force's other prowlers. In most cases, there would be a single Spartan on the flight deck and 1 in the drop bay. John had 4 prowlers and only 12 Spartans. That meant the vessels with a full team were the 2 flight leads, the Black Widow with John's blue team, and the Quiet Man with Kurt 051's green team. Gold team was split among the 2 remaining prowlers, with a pair of Spartans aboard each craft. John reached the Widow's flight deck and stepped into the compartment without asking permission. It was a terrible breach of shipboard decorum, and Esme Gite, the naval lieutenant who commanded the flight, shot him a fiery scowl. John pretended not to notice and remained beside her command chair, studying her through the anonymity of his mirrored faceplate. She was a compact woman with black hair, brown eyes, and a round face. Like the quiet flight commander, Lim Jin-Wu, Gite had actually been raised on Earth, and she had attended the Luna OCS Academy in Mare Nubium, which was about 90% of the reason John had chosen them for Sierra Force. Of all the flight commanders in Task Force Yama, they seemed least likely to be harboring hidden insurrectionist sympathies. But they were also Naeto's subordinates, and John would be fooling no one, including himself, if he tried to pretend the orders he was about to relay didn't border on mutiny. The slipspace formation appeared ahead, a band of dark voids hanging against the veil of stars beyond the forward viewport. There were no running lights or illuminated viewports to help define their shapes more precisely. This deep in alien space, it was not wise to increase the risk of being spotted by a passing patrol. Naeto's ghost song was moving into formation with the most distant cluster of vessels, its thrust nozzles a triangle of barely visible purple disks. Gite looked away from her command screen long enough to glance up at John, no doubt intending to make a pointed inquiry about what he needed on her flight deck, then noticed the new insignia at the top of his chest plate, and raised her brow. Where did that come from? John tipped his helmet down toward her. Colonel Crowther wanted to see how it looked on a suit of Mjolnir armor, ma'am. He turned his gaze forward again. I guess he liked it. Naeto's voice sounded over the flight deck speakers. Dagger Force, bring all weapons and power to battle ready. Execute slip in 5, 4. The stars beyond Dagger Force began to dance and twinkle as long tongues of efflux shot from the thrust nozzles of a dozen vessels. Then the prowlers were gone, a field of bright purple disks shrinking to a thumb-sized dot in the duration of a blink, the dot vanishing into the blue crackle of a slipspace vortex. Gite extended a finger toward the comm selector on the arm of her chair. Not yet, ma'am. Gite glanced at him in puzzlement and left her finger on the selector. The timing of this operation is intricate, Master Chief. If Sierra Force doesn't enter slipspace as scheduled, not yet, John repeated. He pulled the data chip from an equipment pouch and handed it to her. New orders. Gite's eyes narrowed, but she accepted the data chip and slipped it into a reader slot. Colonel Crowther's face appeared on her command screen. Lieutenant Gite, I am sure you will recall the conversation we had about operational security, the image said. It pains me to say that was not idle speculation. Operation Silent Storm has been compromised, and as of this moment, you will consider Commander Naeto relieved of command. Gite stopped the message and looked over at John. This was the critical moment, he knew. While Crowther's rank was superior to her own, he was not actually in her chain of command. She would be well within protocol to ignore his instruction and carry on with the orders she had been given by Naeto. You knew about this? Gite asked. We're the ones he's been trying to kill. And that's why there's a Spartan standing on the flight deck of both my prowlers? Yes, ma'am. And it's why we swept them for eavesdropping devices as soon as we boarded, John said. Would you like to see what we found? That won't be necessary, she said. How would I know they aren't props you brought along to impress me? Gite started the message again, and Crowther's image continued. I have provided an alternate vector through which you should exit slipspace. The transit specifications are embedded at the end of this message. As you know, John 117 has been given command of Sierra Force. I hope and expect you'll honor that, no matter what your feelings are about Commander Naeto. Crowther saluted, and the message ended. Gite sat staring at her blank command screen in silence, then turned and eyeballed John's new rank insignia for a time. Finally, she broke her reverie and said, Very well, Master Chief. You're in charge. She began to tap the keypad on the arm of her command chair. Please try not to get us killed. Chapter 24. 1458 hours, April 15th, 2526. Military calendar. UNSC Razor-class Prowler Ghost Song. Libration Point 3. Naraka Rudara. Agni System. The Covenant outpost came into view, a smudge of green light dead ahead of the Ghost Song's hushed flight deck. It was blurred by the dust and detritus that always collected in libration points. Those odd pockets in space where the gravity of two orbiting masses, In this case, a planet and its moon interacted to create zones of equilibrium that could be used to park objects in a fixed relative position. In the Naraka Rudara system, the aliens had parked picket squadrons at libration points 3, 4, and 5. The deployment created an equilateral triangle that was perfect for defending the orbital facilities around the distant, pearl-colored marble of the alien supply world. And it was Dagger Force's job to neutralize those picket squadrons, so Sierra Force could stage a clean attack. Ghost Flight was assigned to hit Libration Point 3, on the opposite side of Naraka from its moon, Rudara, both names picked by Dr. Halsey, as she had not yet determined their Covenant names. According to the battle plan, that would be the side of the planet from which Sierra Force approached with the Spartans and 139 Black Daggers. And it was Avery Johnson's job to make sure that when Lieutenant Commander Hector Nieto tried to sabotage the mission, he would be exposed for the traitor he was. The alien outpost grew from a green smudge to a thumb-sized dust cloud, with dozens of glowing points inside. Half of those lights were probably support stations rather than combat vessels, but still. Ghost Flight was outnumbered more than 5-1. If they failed to attack with surprise, they stood no chance of neutralizing the picket squadron, or even surviving the effort. A crisp female voice rose from the navigator's station. 5 minutes, Commander. Nieto, seated in his command chair near the back of the compartment, glanced over with a look that suggested Avery had no business being there. Fair enough. With 5 minutes to go before jump, Avery was standing on the flight deck in full assault armor. It certainly looked like he was supposed to depart with 1st Platoon Alpha. Avery was actually there to back up Colonel Crowther, who stood next to him in Service Dress B, a formal working uniform with a khaki shirt and tie appropriate to the task at hand. Weapons weren't allowed on the flight deck, so neither of them was openly carrying. But Avery had hardened cargo pouches on his thigh armor that could clearly hold concealed sidearms. Only a fool would not realize something was up. When Avery made no move to depart, Nieto frowned and turned to the Ghost Song sensor operator. "What is detection telling us?" he asked. "Any sign of Sierra Force yet?" The operator, a senior petty officer, shook his head. "Negative, Commander. I should have had a Tau surge from their transition sector by now. Nothing." Nieto checked his chronometer, then rubbed his chin and made a point of not looking toward Johnson and Crowther. Prowlers could be difficult to detect even when their location was known, so the mission plan called for him to assault the libration point whether or not he confirmed Sierra Force's arrival. Even from profile, Johnson could see Nieto's eyes narrowing as he struggled with his decision. Unless he knew the Spartans' location before Ghost Flight attacked, he wouldn't be able to do anything to make the Covenant look in that direction. But with Johnson and Crowther present, he had to realize that any deviation from a plan would only confirm to them what he was really up to. Finally, Nieto said, "There's no point in attacking if Sierra Force isn't ready." Avery tried to remain relaxed. Nieto was starting to go off protocol now. Once he pushed too far, Crowther would have clear cause to relieve him of command and take over. Of course, there was a good chance that Nieto recognized what was happening right in front of him and would stop just short of any clear violation. That was okay, too. The mission would be in less jeopardy. But the traitor was nothing if not determined, and Nieto seemed to realize that no matter how today turned out, this would be the last chance he had to eliminate the Spartans. He turned to his communications officer. "Prepare a burst transmission requesting ready confirmation." "And send it where, Commander?" Burst transmissions were usually targeted, point-to-point communications that could be sent with only a small chance of detection. The drawback, of course, was that the target's location had to be known. Which it obviously wasn't, which meant Nieto was about to go too far. The only question was, how would the crew react when Crowther relieved him of command? A lot of Nieto's people came from outer colony worlds where insurrectionist sympathies were common, and the commander could not have single-handedly planted and monitored all the eavesdropping devices that had been discovered around the task force. There had to be at least a few loyalists aboard the Ghost Song working with Naedo, and one or two might even be on the flight deck right now. And that was the reason why Avery was standing next to Crowther with a pair of M6C pistols in his thigh pouches. Naedo checked his chronometer again, then said, "The Covenant will know they're under attack in a few minutes anyway." He tapped his fingertips on the arm of his chair three times, as though deep in thought. Then sighed and said, "Broadcast it in the open." "Belay that order," Crowther said. Johnson felt an almost imperceptible shudder beneath his feet, as though the Ghost Song were reacting to Crowther's audacity. The communications officer paused only long enough to glance to Naedo for a confirming nod, then began to prepare the burst transmission. Nobody seemed to be looking in Avery's direction, so he let his hands drift over his thigh pouches and slipped his fingers under the flip-up covers. Crowther's gaze moved from the communications officer to Naedo. "Commander, sending that microburst will accomplish nothing," he said. "There won't be a response, because Sierra Force already knows exactly what you really are. I'm hereby relieving you of command and charging you with treason against the UNSC." "Relieving me of command?" Naedo laughed and leaned forward, his left hand dropping out of view down in front of his chair. "That's funny." In a flash, Avery drew both pistols from his thigh pouches. He aimed one at the back of Naedo's chair and offered the other to Crowther, but the flight deck sensor operator was already spinning around, bringing up an M6E sidearm. The muzzle flashed twice, and Crowther went down with a crater in his forehead and blood spurting from his clavicle. Avery returned fire with both pistols, blasting the sensor operator from his seat and putting two rounds into Naedo's chair, then realized he was stumbling back, his torso armor hammering into his chest as he took round after round, the attack coming from the navigator and the co-pilot. Hell, even the communications officer was now firing at him, and she was supposed to be preparing a burst transmission. Apparently everyone on the flight deck was a damn traitor. Knowing his armor could not keep absorbing bullet impacts forever, Avery backed away through the flight deck hatch, still shooting, then started down the starboard passageway and saw a trio of crewmen coming toward him. All three were armed with M7 submachine guns, but holding their weapons muzzle down as they raced into combat. Not infantry trained, clearly. Avery charged, emptying his clips as he ran. There was a very small chance that the three crewmen were a legitimate security detail, reacting to an order from their commander. But of course there was no way to sort that out in the middle of a firefight. One of the trio sprayed a burst into the wall as he went down, but those were the only shots any of them managed to fire. Avery tucked his pistols into his thigh pockets, then snatched up the two submachine guns that hadn't been discharged and started aft. He didn't like leaving the third weapon behind when it might be used against him later, but the situation had gone south in a hurry. As much as he refused to believe an entire flight crew could go renegade, there was no arguing with what had happened to Crowther. Hell, from what he had observed so far, the Ghost Song's entire complement could be insurrectionist traitors. He needed immediate reinforcements. Avery brought up the assault armor's HUD and I-selected 1st Platoon Alpha's comm channel. "Red Eagle," the prearranged code that would tell 1st Platoon to take the Prowler by force. "Red Eagle, now!" 5 meters down the passageway, two hatches slid open simultaneously on either side of the corridor. One led into the two-deck engineering hold in the middle of the vessel, the other into a crew cabin. Firing both weapons, Avery put a suppression burst through each portal. A second later, once he was sure his would-be attackers were ducking ricochets instead of watching the passageway, he stopped firing and raced past, then spun around and found two gun barrels emerging from each opening. One was high and the other low, which was smart. But all four weapons were pointed up the passageway in the direction he had been coming from, which was dumb. Avery stepped between the hatches and emptied an M7 magazine into each opening, firing low first because he knew the recoil would naturally cause the weapons to rise. The air filled with red mist and smoke, and four bodies tumbled out into the passageway. "Damn, Sarge!" Captain Ham's voice sounded inside Avery's helmet, coming over the Alpha Company command channel. "Leave a few for the rest of us. There's plenty to go around." As he spoke, Avery was careful to keep an eye on the motionless crewman lying at his feet. It was still remotely possible that one or two were alive. Crowther's dead. Looks like the whole crew was with Naedo. All of Ghost Flight, actually, Ham said, and they were expecting this. Another brilliant observation from an officer. Avery took his eyes off the dead crewman just long enough to check the passageway behind him. Relieved to see Ham approaching with a pair of black daggers beside her, he smashed the stocks of the empty M7s against the edge of the hatchway and took a replacement from the hands of a petty officer first class who had died with his one remaining eye wide open. By then, Ham was stepping to Avery's side, motioning the two black daggers to check the compartments beyond the body-clogged hatches. Only then did Avery feel secure enough to take a longer look back down the passageway toward the drop bay. There were only two more assault troopers in the passageway. "Where's the rest of the platoon?" "Vact," Ham said. "Your Red Eagle was a tad late." Avery's heart sank. "Damn it. Naedo blew the jump hatch?"
"About 20 seconds before you called," she said. "The decompression caught us by surprise. Took about 2 blinks to empty the bay."
Connor grabbed the hatch release, and I held onto his ankles, watching everybody go. It was like seeing a vacuum cleaner suck sardines out of the can. Avery thought for a moment. Naedo had told the comm officer to broadcast in the open, and tapped his fingers on the arm of his chair. "Oh, damn," Avery said. "Naedo gave his crew a go signal. It was nonverbal, but I should have caught it. Warned you. I'm so sorry." Ham waved him off. "They're still alive, Sergeant. Our guys were buttoned up," she said. "All we have to do is take the flight deck and go pick them up." "After we hit the L point," Avery said. "We don't do that. This mission is a bust." "The night watch is carrying on," Ham said. The sole surviving prowler from watch flight, the night watch had been attached to Ghost Flight to replace the Ghost Star, which had been lost at Seoba. She's carrying 3rd Platoon under Olinda MacDonald. "I thought 3rd Platoon was at half strength after Seoba." "They are," Ham said. "But Olinda is kind of the Black Dagger version of John 117. Stubborn as hell and doesn't know when to quit. She'll get the job done, one way or another." A couple of assault rifle bursts sounded inside the engineering hold. Then Ham's trooper returned and gave a thumbs up. Ham looked up the passageway in the direction of the flight deck. "How many did you get down there, Lindbergh?"
2, Lindbergh reported. Her voice was a bit quavery. "Not sure whose side they were on, but they had weapons and wouldn't drop them."
"That makes them the enemy," Ham said, reassuring her. "Johnson, how many have you taken out?"
7 in the passageway.
7?
"Plus the sensor operator on the flight deck," Avery added.
He didn't care for the note of surprise in Ham's voice. It made him think she had a poor opinion of what old sergeants could do.
"Maybe Naedo, too."
"Just maybe?"
"Best I could do."
Avery pointed to the dimples in his chest armor. "I was taking fire and trying to shoot Naedo through a chair."
"We'll take it from here, Sergeant."
Ham sounded amused. She turned to the two troopers who had been waiting behind them. "Counting our measly 6, that's 14. That means Naedo still has 2 crewmen running around loose, and someone might have left the flight deck, too. Don't let us get surprised." The troopers answered almost in unison, with young-sounding voices.
"Yes, ma'am."
Ham turned to the trooper who had checked the crew cabin. He had a flat black second lieutenant's bar on the collar of his armor, which made him 1st Platoon's new lieutenant, Nolan Connor.
"Let's take this bat, Nolan," she said. "I don't want our people adrift any longer than necessary."
"Yes, ma'am."
Connor pulled a coil of thermite carbon cord from one thigh pouch and a pair of flashbangs from the other.
"Which do you want, Sergeant?"
Before answering, Avery glanced around at the weaponry everyone was carrying. All 5 of the Black Daggers held MA-5B assault rifles, which were decent weapons for close-quarters boarding actions. Their selectors were set to 3-round burst fire, and the red paint on their magazines meant they were loaded with hollow-point ammunition that was perfect for the current circumstances, highly effective against unarmored personnel, but unlikely to penetrate equipment cabinets, hulls, or viewports. They knew how to take a flight deck. Avery clamped the M7 to his armor, then reached for the thermite carbon cord.
"Let me have the TCC," he said. "I wouldn't want to get in your way when the shooting starts."
They moved forward at a trot, the 2 young troopers clearing each compartment they passed. When they finally reached the flight deck,
No one was surprised to find it sealed from the inside. Ham sent the two young troopers to clear the port side of the prowler, then stood watch while Avery pasted the TCC in place. The hatch was designed to suck tight against its seals in the event of a pressure loss in the main body of the ship, so when Avery ignited the TCC, it would fall inward. As it dropped, Connor would toss both flashbangs into the compartment, and Ham would step inside and shoot the traitors while they were still stunned from the flashbangs. And with any luck, they would do all that before Nieto located Sierra Force and started hitting them with tight-beam transmissions to draw the attention of the Covenant. Avery was pressing the cord down the last side when a young trooper's voice sounded over the platoon channel.
"Captain, we can't access the emergency airlock."
"Why not?" Ham asked.
"Unclear. The pressure is unequalized. We should be able to open the hatch."
"What do you see inside?"
"Nothing. The viewport is fogged."
Avery didn't like the sound of that. He came to the corner of the hatch and ran the TCC across the bottom. The whole reason airlocks had viewports was so that if something was wrong, you could look inside and see the problem. He reached the detonation cap and wrapped the extra cord around it to complete the circle, then looked up to see if Ham was ready, and on the wall above her head, saw a dark bulb about the size of a pencil eraser. A security camera. "Oh, shit," he said. Ham's faceplate dropped in his direction as a tremendous boom sounded somewhere aft, and she rose off her feet and flew down the passageway, bouncing off the bulkhead and vanishing down the portside passageway. And Avery went tumbling after her, his arms and legs tangled with Connor's, and together they hit the bulkhead and ricocheted down the portside passageway after the captain. The air was filled with blankets and pillows and clothes, tools and crates and weapons, all of it sailing toward the midpoint of the passageway and disappearing through a jagged hole where the emergency airlock used to be. Avery saw Ham being drawn toward the breach, flailing and clawing at the bulkheads. Then she jackknifed at the waist and went through the hole. Connor was next, back arching and head going first. Avery's stomach rose as though he were falling. Then he felt himself bend at the waist, and suddenly he, too, was out among the stars, his ragged breath roaring in his ears and his heart hammering in his chest. Vact. Avery was not wearing a thruster pack, so he had only his assault armor's integrated maneuvering jets to stop his tumble. He began to fire them carefully, in half-second bursts that slowly brought his spinning under control. Then his head over heels flipping, and finally the stars stopped whirling past in mad paisley patterns, and he found himself adrift in the emptiness. The comm channels inside his helmet were not quite silent. He could hear Ham and the others huffing into their helmet mics, trying to bring their own breathing under control. There was a clatter that sounded like chattering teeth, and a low growl that was probably a young trooper groaning in pain. Avery used the suit's finger position maneuvering controls to begin a slow spin, and quickly located a nearby mass of shadow that could only be the Ghost Song. Beyond it to the left lay the outpost in Libration Point 3, now a thumb-sized smudge of green dotted with flecks of brightly lit installations. Naraka itself lay beyond the Libration Point, a massive emerald disk swaddled by ribbons of golden cloud, with a heavy band of orbital facilities twinkling high above its equator. There was no sign of the rest of 1st Platoon Alpha, which was no doubt dozens of kilometers away by now, after being decompression launched out of the drop bay. Nor did Avery see any sign that the Ghost Song had located Sierra Force yet, though he knew that couldn't last. Sooner or later, Nieto or one of his people would spy a cluster of wedge-shaped silhouettes diving toward Naraka, blotting out distant stars as they moved to attack. After that, it would be a simple matter for the traitors to do their work, to send a message, or even a missile, that would warn the Covenant of the approaching Spartans. And there was only one way to stop them. Avery activated his emergency locator beacon, then watched in delight as a dozen bright slivers of light appeared inside the Covenant outpost and came streaking in their direction.
"Johnson!" Ham snapped over the 1st Platoon channel. "Are you trying to get us captured?"
"No, ma'am." Johnson grinned as all three of Nieto's prowlers suddenly fired their engines and turned to flee.
"I'm trying to get Commander Nieto killed."
Chapter 25.
15:19 hours, April 15th, 2526, military calendar. UNSC Razor-class Prowler Black Widow, insertion approach, planet Naraka, Agni system. The harsh beep of a heads-up alarm broke over the Black Widow's flight deck, and John 117's heart climbed into his throat. With Sierra Force approaching Naraka and Dagger Force already infiltrating the enemy's libration point outposts, the assault plan was both immutable and at its most vulnerable. His HUD showed 11 minutes before a wave of nuclear detonations was due to take out the Covenant picket squadrons. During the confusion that followed, the four prowlers of Sierra Force would penetrate the alien defenses and insert a platoon of Spartan-led space assault troopers at four different locations near the orbital fleet support ring. The platoons would then use EV tactics to board and destroy as many facilities as possible from the inside, using time-fused nuclear devices and tubs of a high-yield explosive called octanitrocubane. Nicknamed Octas, the tubs cost more to produce than a Havoc thermonuclear device, but they were worth it because they were shaped charges, and their explosive yield did not decrease in a vacuum. But none of that would matter if Sierra Force wasn't in position when Dagger Force began its attack. The sensor operator silenced the heads-up alarm, then turned toward the commander's chair at the back of the flight deck. "Ma'am, that was a space assault distress beacon transmitting in the open." The sensor operator glanced toward John, then added, "The identifier reads Staff Sergeant A. Johnson." "Avery Johnson?" Esme Gite's voice betrayed her surprise. Dressed in black utilities with her name and lieutenant's rank appropriately displayed, she was a small woman with stocky limbs who nevertheless made the oversized chair seem as though it had been built just for her. She regained her composure, then asked, "Any other signals?" "Negative." The communications officer, sitting at her station on the opposite side of the flight deck from the sensor operator, pressed a fingertip to her earphone. "Actually, ma'am," she said, "I'm picking up some suit chatter on the first platoon AlphaCom channel. I don't have their encryption up, but if you give me a minute, I'll let you know if I need it." Gita kept her attention fixed on the sensor operator. "Ensign Jones, what's the enemy reaction?" "Heavy," Jones reported. "I have 9, make that 10 frigate-sized vessels departing the Point 3 outpost." "What vector?" "Too early to tell," Jones replied. "Could be the emergency beacon. Or it could be us." "Very well," Gite said. "Keep me informed." She looked over at John. She was no doubt thinking the same thing he was. If the communications officer was picking up suit-to-suit chatter, it could only mean Avery Johnson wasn't the only soldier floating around out there. Clearly, something had gone very wrong with the effort to take control of Hector Naedo's prowlers. Gite continued to look at John. Finally, he realized what she was waiting for. He couldn't believe what he was about to say, but Avery Johnson understood signals discipline as well as anyone. He would never compromise the mission by activating an emergency beacon the enemy was sure to detect. The only reason he would do something that drastic was that he wanted the Covenant to hear it. John just wished he understood why. "I think we have to stick to the plan." John was careful to phrase his decision as a suggestion. Crowther might have put him in charge of the mission, but he was enlisted, and Gite was the highest-ranking officer aboard the Prowler. If push came to shove, there could be no doubt whom the crew would obey. "We need to stay on mission." Gite's lips tightened, but she gave John a crisp nod. "Very well, Master Chief." She turned forward again. "Detection. Continue to monitor the signal. Navigation. Fix the location for return. We'll try to swing by later and pick them up."
"Ma'am, that assault armor only has 90 minutes of air," the navigator said.
"Even if the aliens don't..."
"You heard the Master Chief," Gite said. "Do your damn job and fix the location."
"Yes, ma'am." An uneasy silence fell over the flight deck. John might have just condemned Avery Johnson and dozens of Black Daggers to death. But the sergeant would also have been the first to tell him to do it. If Sierra Force failed to destroy the fleet support facilities at Naraka, the Covenant would be able to resupply and resume their invasion of the outer colonies unimpeded. And allowing that could mean the end of humanity.
Only a few seconds passed before the sensor operator said, "Ma'am, I've lost the beacon, and I think the aliens have too, if they ever had it. They're accelerating on a vector that bypasses Sergeant Johnson's location." "Will they also bypass Sierra Force?" Gite asked. "Could be close," the sensor operator replied. "I'll pass my data to navigation for vector analysis." "Very well," Gite said. "Comms, prepare for a Sierra Force burst transmission with a new course and instructions." John's gut clenched. Even if the Covenant failed to detect the burst transmission itself, a change of course order would cause a cascade of messages and thruster burns, as four prowlers coordinated to minimize the chances of collision. A top-notch prowler wing like Sierra Forces might be able to pull that off without alerting the aliens to their presence, but it would be a long shot. "I have that vector analysis," the navigator reported. "It looks like a 100-kilometer miss, but they could be trying to position themselves to swing around for a tail attack. Comms, stand by." Gite's gaze grew distant. 100 kilometers in open space was practically a sideswipe, and John knew she had to be debating the best course of action. "Ma'am, I think we take the chance," John said. "Between the emergency beacon and the comm chatter, there's something going on with Ghost Flight. The Covenant is probably reacting to that, not us." Gite shifted her attention to John. "Even if you're right, at 100 kilometers, sheer proximity raises our chances of being detected to 30%, and that's with human sensors. Still has to beat our chances of changing course undetected. Assuming you're right about what the aliens are doing." "Ma'am, I don't know whether the Master Chief is right," the navigator said, "but the alien vector is odd. It intersects our original approach." "The one we abandoned after Dagger Force entered slipspace?" Gite asked. "Yes, ma'am," the navigator said. "It's like they were expecting us to be there." "Not us," John said. He was beginning to think he knew why Johnson had activated his emergency beacon. "Could they be chasing a Ghost Flight prowler?" "It's possible," the sensor operator said. "But why would a prowler leave—" "Just keep watching that vector," Gite ordered. She had obviously reached the same conclusion John had. Avery Johnson had activated his emergency beacon not to call for help, but to draw the Covenant's attention and prevent Hector Nieto from sabotaging Sierra Force's arrival. But even with an enemy squadron on his prowler's tail, Nieto had not given up. Now he was trying to lead the aliens into Sierra Force headlong, and he might have succeeded had John not changed their approach vector just before Sierra Force entered slipspace. After a moment, Gite added, "And look for a tau burst. If the Master Chief is right about who the Covenant is chasing, that prowler won't be coming back to help us out." The sensor operator was quiet for a moment, then said, "Understood. I'll keep you informed." The flight deck quieted again. A tau burst, John knew, occurred any time a slipspace vortex opened. Tau particles were extremely short-lived, less than a billionth of a second, so they were impossible to detect unless a sensor dish happened to be pointed directly at the vortex. Even then, it wasn't the tau particle that was actually observed, but the burst of energy that occurred when it encountered its antimatter complement and self-destructed. John checked his HUD. The first nukes were due to detonate in the libration point outposts in just over 5 minutes. Given the apparent trouble that had befallen 1st Platoon Alpha, he did not expect to see any bright flashes at Libration Point 3. But the Black Widow was far enough away from Naraka that any detonations at Libration Points 4 and 5 should be visible to either side of the planet, in about the same plane as its equator. "Covenant squadron reaching closest approach in 30 seconds, the navigator said. "And they've opened fire with their plasma cannons," the sensor operator added. "On us?" Gite exclaimed. "Sorry, ma'am, no. On whoever they're chasing." "Very well. Carry on." Gite's voice had dropped back into its normal calm tone. "Comms, prepare burst message reading, break, break, engage all weapons. Hold transmission for my order. Acknowledged." John fixed his gaze on the port side of the viewport and quickly spied a handful of blue slivers approaching from the direction of Libration Point 3. Though the distance was minuscule by the standards of space, He never saw a glint or silhouette that suggested the vessel itself. Even the plasma bolts the aliens were firing at the fleeing prowler were barely more than flecks of light. Then, almost before he knew it, the slivers had passed out of sight. The tension on the flight deck bled away, and a dozen breaths later, the sensor operator reported, "Covenant Squadron continuing on Vector. No indication they've detected us." Gite exhaled hard, then said, "Comms, kill that burst transmission." She turned to John. "Nice call, Master Chief." John thought of Avery Johnson. "I hope so." He checked his HUD. In 2 minutes, the nukes should start detonating and taking out picket squadrons and libration point outposts. If all went to plan, Sierra Force would drop 10 minutes later and start attacking the ring of orbital fleet support facilities that encircled Naraka. The facilities were connected by a transit tube, enclosed within a skeletal frame of support trusses. Dr. Halsey had called it a trussing armature when she saw the reconnaissance vids, and the objective of the attack was to destroy enough of the armature to take down the entire ring. If Sierra Force could destroy at least 10 facilities, along with the connecting armature, there was a 92% chance that the orbit of the entire ring would grow unstable and fall into a rapid, irreversible decay. At least that was what Dr. Halsey said, and she did not make a habit of being wrong. "We have tau bursts," the sensor operator reported. "Several. I make it 3 separate vessels, all entering slipspace in close formation." John was stunned. During their planning sessions for this mission, Crowther and Johnson had speculated about how deep the conspiracy might go, but nobody had even suggested that it might include all 3 Prowlers in ghost flight. Gite looked over. "Surprised?" "Yes, ma'am, you could say that," John said. "The Prowler Corps is an Oni division. How could Naedo crew 3 entire craft with traitors?" "Easier than you think," Gite said. "Commanders approve all crew replacements. Once Naedo had his flight, he could start slipping in his people every time there was a transfer." "For the entire crew of 3 Prowlers?" John still couldn't believe it was possible. "That would take years." "Maybe decades." Gite turned forward again. "Put yourself in Naedo's place, John. To the insurrectionists, we're the alien invaders. The horde that can't be stopped. They've already been fighting us for 30 years any way they can. Just like we're fighting the Covenant now. If that meant spending 20 years in the UNSC just to steal a few prowlers, then that's what he'd do." A brilliant flash caught the corner of John's left eye. He turned to see white spheres blossoming into existence at the libration points to either side of Naraka's equator, then shrinking back into nothingness, one after another in a beautiful, blinding storm of annihilation. A few more flashes lit up the port edge of the Black Widow's viewport as a handful of thermonuclear devices detonated at the Libration Point 3 outpost, but it was nothing like the eruption of light coming from the other 2 outposts. And no wonder. With the alien picket squadron out chasing ghost flight, the only targets left at Point 3 would be a few support stations. "Sensors, what's the status of the Covenant squadron behind us?" "Intact," the sensor operator said. "And coming around. Looks like they're responding to the attack." "Keep an eye on them," Gite said. She looked over at John. "It'll be a hot insertion." John shrugged. "Is there any other kind?" Actually, he had led hostile insertions only a handful of times, most recently when the Spartans attacked the logistics fleet at Etalon. But he was pretty sure that no insertion was ever easy. There would always be someone willing to do whatever it took to keep the UNSC from setting foot on their ground. "Just get us within EV range of the orbital ring," John added. "We'll handle the rest." "Deal." Gite's gaze was locked forward, where Naraka's mottled green disk was expanding rapidly across the viewport. Already its ring of fleet support facilities could be seen orbiting above the equator, a ragged band of curled shapes connected to one another by the yellow-green filament of a transit tube. The shapes ranged in size from almost indiscernible to as large as John's fist, and they were flecked with the twinkling lights and glowing bubbles of active industrial facilities. Beneath a handful of these facilities, spokes of blue light descended into Naraka's yellow cloud cover and vanished from sight. In front of the orbital ring hung 20 Covenant vessels, each so large that John mistook them for facilities in the ring itself, until he noticed the bright specks swarming around them and realized he was looking at a fighter shell. Even then, it took him a moment to recognize the problem. The ships had no thrust tails. Instead of climbing into higher orbits to expand their defensive cocoon and compensate for the loss of their picket squadrons, they were hanging back in orbit, maintaining a tight anti-infiltration web that would prevent the prowlers from slipping through to attack the orbital facilities.
"Good discipline," Gite said. "They're not falling for it."
"Imagine that," John said. "Someone leaked our plan."
"Maybe," Gite said. "But the aliens aren't idiots. After Edelon, they could have guessed what we'd do.
But not where we'd do it." John pointed at the line of slowly growing vessels ahead. "Does that look like a typical garrison force? Or a typical deployment?"
"I'm no expert on Covenant garrison force deployments," Gite said. "But no.
To deploy that tight around the entire ring, they'd have to keep 100 carrier-sized vessels on station. Nobody does that unless they're expecting trouble."
"So we do this the hard way," John said. "Plan D."
"I didn't know there was a plan D."
"There is now." John explained what he had in mind, then asked, "What do you think?"
"They're expecting us to attack the fleet support ring from a higher orbit, so we hit it from below.
If we can get below."
John pointed at the faint beam connecting the ring to Naraka. "Those spokes look a lot like the gravity elevators their ships use. Drop our Sierra units on the surface near the bottom of them, and we'll use the Covenant's own lift tech to infiltrate the ring. It has to be easier than getting through that defensive line."
Gite sighed. "Probably so. Even the Covenant can't put a net that tight over an entire planet."
She studied her command screen for a moment, then asked, "Detection, what are we seeing over the poles?"
"Standard patrols. Nothing we can't dodge."
"Very well."
Gite turned to John.
"Are you sure you want to split up? Massed firepower is easier to eliminate with superior massed firepower," John said. "We're never going to punch through that line. We don't have the strength to do that. We have to slip through, and splitting up makes that easier. It also gives Sierra Force 4 chances instead of just 1 to reach the ring."
"Reaching the ring is only half the battle, Chief," Gite said. "To bring it down, you still have to destroy 10 facilities, and that won't happen if you're short of firepower."
"We won't be," John said. "With all due respect, ma'am, you don't understand Spartan capabilities."
Gite thought for a moment, then said,
"Okay, we'll split up.
But even if we can get you in, retrieval is out of the question. If those spokes aren't what you think they are..."
"Just get us in, ma'am," John said. "We'll find our own ride home."
John left the other half of that statement unspoken. "If we're around to need it." His plan was necessarily short on detail, since he had no intelligence about what they would find on the planet's surface. But it was fair to say that if those spokes weren't some sort of space elevator, getting home would be the least of Sierra Force's problems. After a moment, Gite nodded.
"Very well, Master Chief. You're in charge."
She turned to her command screen and began to type orders.
"I just hope you know what you're doing."
"I'm sure you're not the only one, Lieutenant." John came to attention. "With your permission, I'll retire to the drop bay and prepare for insertion."
"I think you'd better."
Gite spoke without looking away from her command screen. "We're not going to bother with establishing orbit. This will be a meteor insertion. I'll burst the other prowlers with your plan, and you'll be boots down in 16 minutes. She turned to the communications officer and began to issue instructions for the burst transmission. Taking her change of focus as an informal dismissal, John retreated to the drop bay, where he joined the rest of Blue Team and 3rd Platoon Delta Company. Talking as he worked, John explained the new plan and began securing weapons and devices to his armor. He put an MA-5B with underslung grenade launcher on his dorsal magnetic mount, and because he wanted a weapon with the power to penetrate the enemy's personal energy shielding, elected to hand-carry an M-90 close-assault shotgun. He joined the rest of Blue Team in loading up with explosive devices, 100 kiloton Octa on each hip, and a 30 megaton Havoc on his lower back. Not being biologically augmented Spartans in Mjolnir power armor, Lieutenant Small Bear carried a 1 megaton Fury, and her 31 black daggers each carried a pair of Octas mag-clamped above their thruster packs. John wondered if this was some kind of record for the most nuclear ordnance ever carried by an insertion force, comprised entirely of infantry. And he wasn't even considering the other Spartan and Black Dagger teams aboard the remainder of Sierra Force's prowlers with similar kits. It'd definitely make for one hell of a fireworks show, hopefully one they would all be enjoying from a safe distance. A few minutes later, the team was ready, and the Black Widow was beginning to shudder as she plunged into Naraka's atmosphere. The Spartans made their way to the jump hatch at the back of the bay. Anticipating a dismount under fire, John assigned Fred and Kelly to lead the way, followed by 12 ODSTs each. He and Linda would dismount next. That way the platoon would have Spartan firepower both leading the way and coming up in support, and Colonel Crowther wouldn't chew his butt about leading from the front. Lieutenant Small Bear would bring up the rear of the formation with the remaining ODSTs, in case the situation really went south and the platoon needed someone to take charge of fixing the mess. The illumination in the drop bay dimmed briefly, indicating 3 minutes to hatch open, then came back to full, indicating a perilous daylight dismount. Couldn't be avoided. With 4 prowlers hitting targets spread evenly around the planet's equator, only half of Sierra Force's teams were going to be dismounting under cover of darkness. John called for final checks and ran through his own systems list, then turned to exchange visual inspections with Linda. A crackling roar grew inside the bay as atmospheric friction began to heat the Black Widow's hull. John's HUD showed the temperature inside the compartment climbing rapidly, and the prowler began to buck so hard that even the Spartans had to take a knee to keep from being knocked off their feet. Gite's voice came over the 3rd Platoon comm channel. "Sorry for the rough ride. We're beginning to attract flies, and I want you on the ground before they start biting. Watch the monitors for a view of your landing zone. We should have a visual soon." She had barely closed the channel before the bulkhead monitors activated, showing nothing but a gauzy yellow haze. John thought for a moment there was some kind of transmission problem. Then the haze grew thin and patchy, offering glimpses of a lush volcanic world of fuming calderas and glowing rifts. A paisley pattern of walled fields and serpentine terraces covered most of the ground that wasn't actively steaming or bubbling. A silvery web of luminous roadways converged on a distant city of ivory domes and golden spires, which huddled around the foot of a soaring column of blue light. As the Black Widow continued to bounce and shudder toward the city, crannies and fissures began to define the domes and spires into separate clusters of tall, slender buildings that rose hundreds of meters tall, twisting and arcing in graceful shapes, seemingly centuries old and looking almost like hand-blown glass. The blue light thickened into a pillar the size of a skyscraper, and dark streaks began to appear inside, shooting up the column with a velocity almost faster than the eye could follow. "Well, that's either a weird alien space elevator, or a weird alien particle cannon," Fred said. "I guess we'll find out which when we step inside." "Those streaks are too big for a particle cannon," Lieutenant Smallbear said, clearly not accustomed to Fred's humor. "But I'm still not sure we can survive that kind of acceleration." "Only one way to find out," John said. "Send Kelly first?" Fred asked. "Very funny," Kelly said, "and you're coming with me." The alert lamps on the bulkheads changed from red to amber. "1 minute," John said. "Can the chatter." The crannies and fissures between the graceful buildings broadened into flyways filled with airborne traffic, and the domes and spires began to loom up higher than the prowler. A series of white circles flared in the bottom of the monitor and quickly shrank into dots as the Black Widow fired 3 Argent V missiles to clear its way to the space elevator. The first missile dropped in behind an oblong flying vehicle with a sleek purple body resting between a pair of gray levitation runners, then blossomed into an orange ball that licked at buildings to both sides of the lane. John had no idea whether the vehicle had been military or civilian, and he tried not to think about it. The simple fact was that it had been between the Black Widow and her objective, and that unlucky turn of affairs had sealed its fate. The next 2 missiles destroyed targets even farther ahead of the prowler, and the flyway quickly began to empty as confused alien pilots swerved down side lanes or dropped toward the street below. The Black Widow leveled out at about half the height of the buildings and continued toward the space elevator, now using her pair of 50-millimeter nose cannons to take out any vehicle not quick enough to clear the lane. The alert lamps began to blink. 30 seconds. John pumped around into his M90. Safety's off. The Black Widow began to decelerate hard. 1,000 meters ahead, the flyway opened into a bustling transfer yard with pavement that looked a lot like a vast sheet of gray-green glass. Hundreds of haulage